Good evening. This is Life Rattle, the story show. I'm your host, Lori Callis. Tonight, on Life Rattle number 1250, we present the final two stories of our Virginia Ashbury showcase. Virginia Ashbury was born in Toronto in 1952, the youngest of three children. She left home at 17, married on her 19th birthday, and had three children. She left her husband, took the kids when they were 8, 6, and 3 years old, and went to live in Peterborough on mother's allowance, where she went to university. In 1985, Ashbury sold everything she had and drove the three kids across Canada to Victoria, BC. She returned 6 weeks later to face the issues she realized she'd run away from. Things were difficult until I was 40, Ashbury says, but now they're better. This year, Virginia Ashbury moved to Hamilton, Ontario. Early every morning, she commutes to Toronto, where she has worked in social services since 1991. Watch for a collection of stories by Ashbury to be published by Life Rattle Press later this year. Virginia Ashbury's voice will sound familiar to Life Rattle listeners. She took over the helm of Life Rattle Radio when co-founder Arnie Achtman died in 2005. Her loyalty, determination, and energy kept Life Rattle on the air. In tonight's show, you'll have the pleasure of listening to her stories. Arnie Achtman said Ashbury writes in direct, accessible language. Her stories show a shrewd observation of human behavior and a fine balance of toughness and tenderness. Ashbury's writing doesn't pull any punches. Her observations can cut like a knife. Or offer the voice of a trusted friend, someone you want in your corner when things get rough. Either way, Ashbury's writing always stands out as honest and believable. In tonight's stories, our narrator, now an adult, has control of the events in her life, to the extent that anyone has control of the events in their life. Let's listen now as Virginia Ashbury reads her story, Dinner and a Movie, tonight on Life Rattle. Please note, tonight's stories, written for and about adults, include material that some listeners may find offensive. Parental discretion is advised.
Dinner and a Movie by Virginia Ashbury. If I cry now, my eyes will puff, and then if he comes to the door, he'll know I was crying. Oh, damn it. This is so unfair. I can't cry because of him, for him, over him, or in spite of him. Let me start at the beginning. Fred works in the same building as me, but at a different unit. He's a sturdy-looking man, chunky graying patches in his thick brown hair, square dark-rimmed glasses, and good teeth. He wears only blue, any possible shade of blue. I've never seen anyone who dresses like this. Every day some new mix of Dockers, jeans, dress pants, sweaters, t-shirts, whatever, but all blue. When I first noticed this about Fred, I remembered hearing that Einstein wore the same outfit every day from a closet full of the same suits and shirts. Fred sits at a workstation cubicle beside my friend Grace. Grace and I meet for lunch on Fridays, and last week she suggests we drag Fred along. At Zelda's on Church Street, we order Eggs Benedict and Pina Coladas all round. Fred insists the mix of eggs and coconut rum is a gift from the gods, and damn it, he's right. We start telling jokes, then realize we all know Tom Lehrer's songs. Halfway through singing a fractured version of Poisoning Pigeons in the Park, we end snorting and gasping, choking on our drinks and lunch. We acted like obnoxious teenagers and may never be welcome back at Zelda's again. In the 6 months we've worked in the same building, I've never noticed Fred. But in the past week, every time I turn a corner, I run smack into him. On Wednesday morning, the collision is literal. That's it, Fred almost yells. Putting his hands on my shoulders and holding me at arm's length, he looks straight at me and declares, God is speaking to us. Do you like Chinese martial arts movies? No, not really, I reply, wondering what is his point. Neither do I, so let's go see one. Okay, when? Is Friday too soon? I've read some of that book, The Rules, and I think I'm getting in under the wire here, he beams. Is it noon yet? I actually giggle. We'll grab dinner on Spadina after work. Then we can walk over to the IMAX at John Street and catch that Crouching Tiger, Hidden Whatever movie. Cool, I say, hoping to sound like this is nothing out of the ordinary for me. I haven't had a date in 10 years. Oh, but I'll have to go home first and change. I almost snort at this. Blue is blue. What's the difference? I'll pick you up at your place, okay? Sure. You live in the beaches, don't you? I say. My place is on the way downtown from there. I'll write out my address and phone number and drop it at your desk later. Great. That's a deal, he says. For the rest of the week, whenever we see each other, we just nod and barely smile, like we have a secret to keep safe. Thursday, after work, I head directly to the Eaton Center. Starting at the north end, I race through all of the women's departments in virtually every store, hoping the perfect outfit will jump out at me. One that says, come hither, respect me. I'm comfortable with who I am. No strings. This is just a date. Spend your life with me. Arriving at the south end food court, I consider finding a pack of razor blades and heading home. Air, that's what I need, I say directly to a 13-year-old with a cell phone glued to her ear. She just rolls her eyes and passes by. Out on Yonge Street, the twinkle and glare of thousands of watts of advertisements crowds out the darkness. With arms akimbo, I lean back and take 3 deep cleansing breaths. Looking north, I can see the Cherokee store. Ah, I think, they never disappoint me. 20 minutes later, I have a pair of polar fleece pants and a matching turtleneck top, all soft and yielding, yet sturdy and blue. Getting home by 9:30, I dye my hair a new shade with mauve highlights. By midnight, I'm trying the new pants on with knee highs, then pantyhose, to figure which gives the best balance of seamless comfort. At 1 a.m., I realize I'm obsessing and go to bed. Arriving at work on Friday morning, I realize that I want to avoid Fred for the day. I'm hoping the evening will be separate from work, special, not just a continuation of what has become daily joking contact. My desk phone message light is blinking. The call is from Fred. He sounds unsteady, hesitant. He tells me that he won't be at work today. A family emergency has come up, but we're still on for tonight. I press the number 5 after the recording is over. The stilted mechanical voice tells me that the message was received at 2:25 a.m. from Fred's home number. I put this out of my mind. Really, it fits with what I wanted, doesn't it? By 5:45 p.m., I'm home and ready. That was 4 hours ago. I've rearranged my hair twice, put on makeup, then cleaned it off twice, paced, and made 3 calls to girlfriends who are not home. At 6:30, then again at 8 o'clock, I reach for the phone to call Grace, but stop myself. She will have personal information on Fred, insight into this callousness, but no, I will not risk becoming office gossip. So here I sit on the sofa, in contrived, formal posture, to gather my poise and composure, hands in my lap, forcing calm. Again, 3 deep breaths. Dignity, that's what I've lost. Monday will be hell. Picking up yesterday's Now magazine, I flip through the pages without attention. There, in the movie section, I see an advertisement for a midnight showing of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Yes. I have plenty of time to pick up an order of chicken fried rice on the way. I will sneak my dinner into the theater, slouch in the back row, and enjoy the extra elbow room. The plan was never for more than a dinner and a movie. I've lost nothing.
That was Virginia Ashbury reading her story, Dinner and a Movie. In our second story tonight, we face the trials of working a night shift, our narrators first, at a transition house for women. Let's listen now as Virginia Ashbury reads her story, Passages.
Passages by Virginia Ashbury. A year and a half out of university, I'm a single mum with three kids, making minimum wage, pulling the crap shifts at Passages 1, a transition house for women fleeing abuse. I've got an ex-husband who pays no support, a car with sunshine coming through the floor, and a really bad cold. My student loan is about to come due. When the call goes out for someone to transfer to another work location, I take it. If I can't change my life, I can at least change the backdrop. The last ragged leaves of late fall still cling in the frozen gutter on the street in front of Passages 2, a tall yellow brick Victorian house. I park my car, grab a handful of tissues from the box on the front seat, and stuff them into my pocket. When I push the intercom button, a crackling voice greets me, and I get buzzed in. A tall, skinny woman with limp brown hair, wearing an oversized green knit sweater and tight jeans, steps out of the office just past the empty living room. She waves a tissue at me, then puts it up to her red nose, blows hard, and nods for me to come into the office. I cough, sneeze, and wipe my nose in reply. "Oh, you've got it too," she says, stepping back into the office. I follow. "I'm Myrna. I hear you volunteered to come here. You nuts or something?" "No, just needed a change," I say. "Well, if you stay here long enough, you will be nuts." Before I can sit down to hear more, Myrna snatches a bundle of keys off a nail driven into the blue, scratched, and chipped office door frame and tells me to follow her. She wants to show me around before she leaves and wants to leave soon. In the doorway, Myrna turns and whispers quickly, "You probably know that they almost closed this house because of low numbers." "Yeah," I say. "Well, we've started taking in women being discharged from the psych wing up at the hospital. It's a difficult mix. Women and kids running from abuse alongside manic and schizophrenic women. It's," she pauses, wipes her nose again, "difficult." We both give our noses a good blow and head toward the dining room. "We've only got one mum with a 7-year-old daughter and two singles from the hospital right now, so we don't have any families doubled up, and it's pretty quiet." We step into a bright yellow room with windows on the south and west walls. Dominating the space is a large oval table surrounded by 10 mismatched chairs. Two women and a little girl sit at the far end. "Hi, ladies, this is Virginia," Myrna announces. Then, waving her hand, she rattles off, "Mary, Charlene, and her daughter Alice." Charlene, a small blonde dressed all in black, with a purple scarf knotted tight around her neck, gathers up the game of solitaire she's been playing, stands, and goes into the kitchen. As she shuffles back and forth with bowls of salad, then a big pan of steaming lasagna from the office, Alice follows her, fetching plates and cutlery. "Virginia is starting here tonight," Myrna says. "She's just transferred over from Passages 1, so I'll just show her around, and then she'll join you for dinner." "I'll make a place for you," says the little girl, setting the table. She's already in pajamas and slippers with damp, freshly washed hair. "Thanks, sweetie," I say. Myrna steps into the kitchen and takes a clipboard off a hook on the first cupboard door. "This is the meal plan for the week," she says, then flips to the third page. "And this is the chore list for the residents. They have to sign up for one big chore weekly and three small ones daily, never the same ones 2 weeks in a row." "Good idea," I say. "Now we better go see where Louise is," Myrna says, stepping back into the hallway. She stops by the office, flicks through the ring of keys she's been carrying, and selects a long brown skeleton key. It fits into an old gray metal box that she pulls out of the top drawer of the file cabinet. This is the meds box. Got to keep it locked. We used to let the residents self-administer till there was a suicide attempt. Now we have to issue them. Louise is one of our ladies from the hospital. She's got to take some of her meds with food, so you have to make sure she shows up for meals. Myrna hands me two plastic pill bottles, and we go into the living room. There's a woman sitting in a white wooden rocking chair. She's wearing a tight red nightgown and a blue terry robe that is stretched partway across a very pregnant belly. Her arms are wrapped tight around her chest, and she's rocking back and forth very fast. "I'm a paranoid schizophrenic," she declares, smiling up at me. "That's nice," I say. "Everyone should have a hobby." Louise slows down a bit, then stops her rocking abruptly. "I tried to kill my two kids, so the CAS says I have to find a family that I can stay with, someone who will help me take care of this baby, or they will take it away from me when it's born." "When are you due?" I ask. 2 weeks," says Louise. Then she starts rocking again, but slower. "Well, come on, Louise, let's go get our dinner now," I say, turning sideways and holding my arm out, pointing down the hall to the dining room. Louise rocks back hard, then on the forward rock she hurls herself out of the chair. I follow her down the hallway with the pill bottles rattling. Myrna hands me the ring of keys, deeks into the office, grabs her bag, and is gone. At the table, the only person who seems to enjoy their dinner is Louise. She continues her rocking, shoveling up food with the rhythm of six rocks forward to every mouthful. Every few minutes she pauses, looks down at her belly, and giggles. Charlene and Alice keep their eyes on their plates. Mary darts her gaze equally at everyone around the table and eats sparingly. Her left hand wanders often to her thin neck where the top button of her heavy gray sweater stays secured. I don't try to spark conversation. Until I have time to go through the notes and review each resident's file, that could do more harm than good. So, after I help Alice and her mum clean the table off, I go into the office, leaving the door open, and take a big black binder marked logbook down off the shelf over the desk. Charlene arrived 3 days ago from a farming community 40 miles north of town. After she burnt the roast last Sunday, her husband took a piece of cordwood and beat her over the back. Then, when she was down on the floor, he straddled her and choked her till she lost consciousness. She's been wearing that purple scarf since coming in. Alice tears up when she sees the bruises on her mother's neck. Silent tears. Nobody has heard her cry out loud yet. I roll the old oak office chair away from the desk for a minute to cough and blow my nose, then roll back to read about the single women. The notes on Louise don't give me much more information than what she volunteered before dinner. The hospital sends these women to us, but will not provide any background because of privacy laws. There is nothing in Mary's file except her bio info. She's 36, from Windsor, and arrived at the house 2 weeks ago. I get up and go into the living room to check on everyone. Louise is there alone, in her rocker, moving so fast she is almost a blur. She's watching Family Feud, calling out the answers before the contestants. I perch on the old red sofa and watch along with her for a few minutes. She's very good, consistently getting the right answers. I'm impressed. "Where are the other residents?" I ask at the first commercial break. Charlene and Alice are already in bed. Charlene thinks they're getting the cold that's going around, and I don't know where Mary went. I start to cough again and go back in the office to find a tissue. Louise passes the office door, heading toward the kitchen. Then I hear her double back. She sticks her head into the office. Mary's in the bathroom. She's wailing. I mean, like, she's crying really bad. "Okay, I'll see what's up," I tell her. "Uh-huh," Louise says, but stays in the doorway till I get up from the chair and squeeze past her. I listen at the bathroom door. Mary's in there, and she's crying in a loud, shuddering gulps. I wait till she stops to take a breath, then I knock on the door. "Yes," Mary stutters in a wet voice.
Mary, when you feel up to it, will you come to the office to talk to me? Okay, she says, in a weak, wavering voice. I go back to the office, where Louise still stands by the door. It's okay, Louise. I'll take care of it. You just go ahead and watch your show. Sure, Louise says, looking relieved, but a little skeptical. I position a box of tissues on a small table between an old red easy chair and my office chair. I figure I'm ready. Mary comes into the room. She's not crying now. Actually, she looks very composed. I get up, close the door behind her, then wave her to the soft chair. I sit across from her, grab a wad of tissues from myself, and lean forward. Mary, you sounded pretty sad a moment ago. Do you want to talk about it? Her lower lip starts to quiver, but she takes a breath in and starts. You're all sick, with a cold. Just me and Myrna, I think. No, Louise had it last week, and I think Charlene and Alice are getting it. And that upsets you, that we're all sick? No, no, she says, leaning forward. You don't understand. Well, tell me, Mary. I want to know why you're so upset. You see, you're all sick, but I'm not. Well, that's okay. You're lucky. No, no, that's why I went to hospital, because there were no marks. I don't understand, Mary. Then Mary starts wringing her hands fast and talking even faster. I was living in Windsor. I lived there, near my mother's place, but I have my own place. My mum takes care of my son. She has custody of him. My husband moved to Toronto. We don't see him anymore. And I went out on Saturday night at 8:45 p.m. That was 6 weeks and 2 days ago, and I went to the hotel at 8:45 p.m., and there was this man. I met him, and he said he liked me. And he came home with me at 11:30 p.m., and we went to bed. And then he went down on me, and he was kissing between my legs, and then he started biting me. He started eating, to eat up inside me, she said, talking faster now, to the wall. He was biting and chewing into me, and I could hear him eating my uterus, and he put his whole head up into me, and he kept eating, and he ate my liver and my kidneys, and he ate my pancreas and my heart and my lungs, and he kept eating, and he went right up inside me, and at 2:45 a.m. his whole body went up inside me, and it hurt. Oh my God, it hurt me. I shift uncomfortably. Mary keeps going. And then I broke into pieces, 3,476 pieces, and then he stopped, and he left me there. He was a big man. He couldn't fit inside me. It made me break up. Then, at 3:25 a.m., he started to put me back together, and it took him all night. At 7:45 a.m., I was all back together. How did he know how to do that? How did he put me back together? He just left then. At 7:50 a.m. in the morning, he left. And then I called the ambulance, and then I told them what he'd done, and they took me to the hospital, and I told them what he did, and they checked me. But there was not one mark. There must be marks. I broke into 3,476 pieces. There must be a mark. Mary stops talking, and her hands become still. Past our silence, I can hear the theme music coming from the living room. Family feud must be over. And now everyone is so sick, and I'm not sick. You see, it's wrong. There's no mark on me, but there should be. And now everyone is sick, and I'm not. Oh, yes, I see. I start, pause, then say, it must be awful to actually believe that something like that really happened. Mary's head jerks up, her eyes fix on mine. She starts to rise up from her chair. Her hands become fists. What do you mean? She shouts. Do you think I am lying? Oh, shit, I'm dead, I think, as I roll my chair back just a little. Mary is breathing hard and not taking her eyes off me. Her mouth stays set in a tight line. This woman is going to hurt me. So, what are your plans for Christmas? I say slowly, leaning back and pretending a casual pose. Mary stays tight, half standing, glaring at me. Then a veil of calm drops over her eyes and her mouth relaxes. Her fists release, and she collapses back into her chair. She takes a small breath in, and speaks in a weak voice. My mum says she'll come pick me up at 6 o'clock p.m. on Christmas Eve. I can go to her place, and she'll bring me back at 4:30 p.m. on Boxing Day. That's great, I say, and then we sit in silence, both just looking around the room for a full 2 minutes. At 5 minutes to midnight, I've got my shift notes written, my coat on, and my purse in my hand. The intercom buzzes, and I hear the overnight worker, Denise, cough her name into the speaker.
That was Virginia Ashbury reading her story Passages. That concludes Life Rattle number 1250. My name is Lori Callis. Arnie Ackman recorded Virginia reading her stories. Life Rattle was created by Guy Allen and Arnie Ackman. Tune into Life Rattle next Thursday to hear more new stories.